wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be.
Welcome back to the Signal to Noise podcast on ProSound Web, sponsored by Shure. I'm Michael Lawrence. I'm the technical editor of ProSound Web and LiveSound International, and I am joined by my mustachioed co-host, Kyle Chernside.
Ta-da!
What's going on, man?
You know, hanging out here in St. Louis, Missouri. I got one of my favorite dudes on the podcast today. Excited to be back again, as usual. We're going to have fun with this one, I think. My friend Bruce Ryder, he is currently the front of house engineer for Five Finger Death Punch. I think I met Bruce. I'll have to ask him while we're doing the interview, but I think I met him probably in the early 2000s, late 90s at the Juke Joint in Springfield, Missouri, when I was the house guy there. And I love the way that he approached his work. So got a ton of questions for him, definitely. Technical, social, otherwise, he's one of the greatest out there. And if you ever have a chance, go hear him mix, because it's quite good. He's always on the cusp of new technology, learning different things, learning new things, and he's always willing to talk and hang out. Bruce was one of the good guys that I'd always see come back into the venue and be like, oh, thank God it's Bruce today. But ladies and gentlemen, from Atlanta, Georgia. I don't know if you're originally from there, but Bruce Ryder.
It's good to be here. I'm Bruce. Yeah, I live in Atlanta, Georgia. I moved here with my wife in 1994, so I say I'm from here. I grew up in Illinois and was born in Minnesota.
And there. Bruce, I've been following you for a little, not as long as Kyle has, but I saw an interview with you a couple of years ago. You were out with Five Finger Death Punch and you had your Midas out there, and I remember that at that time you were doing all the processing and effects right inside the desk, and you were using, like, I think half of the desk inputs for drum channels. So is it still the case? Good. So that was one of the things I want to ask you about. So anyway, I've known your name for a while, so I'm really glad you're here with us today, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you.
It's always a pleasure to talk about sound and mics and music and stuff like that, you know.
So how did you, Five Finger Death Punch is known for a incredibly, I'm going to say over the top, it's a larger than life drum sound, just a big, chunky, huge sound. That's an intimidating task for a front of house engineer to match stuff that's done in the studio like that. So what's your approach to that?
Yeah, well, first, you can't really match what they do in the studio. So I look at it as what they're actually giving me live. When it's the five of them on the stage with their instruments, what they have there is what I have to work with. In the studio, you know, there's, you know, overdubs and, you know, just studio. It's the studio. There's layers of instruments and stuff. So I try to listen to the hooks or whatever, as far as the records go. And learn sort of the whatever I think the important melodies that the audience is going to sing along with, you know. But beyond that, I don't. The record doesn't really matter as much because you can't replicate that, you know.
So it sets a high bar basically for you to try to, you know, how do you take that and reframe it to a live context?
Well, you have to make it fit the room. The audience, first and foremost, they want to hear the vocals, right? They want to hear Ivan singing. And ideally, they want it to sound pleasant, like his voice, you know, natural, you know, like him. You know, they have a, you know, the audience and the singer of this band in particular have a really good connection, you know. So that's the first most important thing. And then after that, you want to hear the music, obviously, you know, and it's heavy metal, so you want it to be nice and loud, but it has to be comfortable and it cannot overpower the vocal, you know, and that's, you know, just getting the vocal out front, but not annoyingly loud, I think is one of the keys, but yeah.
One of the things that I've been working on, I actually sent Kyle. It's funny because I'm a system tech primarily, and Kyle's a mix engineer primarily. So when he's got to do system tech stuff, he's calling me. When I'm trying to deal with mixing, I'm calling him. And one of the things I was working on recently is, how do you get your lead vocal to sound like it's in the mix and not just kind of sitting on top? We don't want to sound like, you know, a karaoke thing. And that's such a delicate balance for me to make sure that it's audible, but it's not. It doesn't sound silly. And so it's interesting to hear you apply that to the heavy metal genre, because that's not, you know, something that I would typically think about, is this is a struggle for a genre like that.
Well, it's very important, because the singer will go from, he's very dynamic. He will go from the loudest scream to the softest cry, you know, and it all has to be in your face. The audience wants to hear every single word he says or sings, you know, even in between songs, you know. So one of the ways that I do that is, whatever songs, when I'm preparing, I always have lyric sheets, and I sort of listen to the songs and get to know the lyrics, and, you know, and then I ride the fader syllable by syllable, pretty much, you know, to keep it at the forefront without ever being lost or without ever overpowering. Because sometimes just like the grunt of a word could send the meters, you know, into peaking or whatever, you know, and sort of overpower the mix. But, you know, the other half of the word, you need the full level of that. So I just riding the fader a lot, like, you know, maybe 15, 20 dB dynamic range on the fader for any given song. And it's, I don't want to say constantly moving, but it's moving quite a lot, you know? So that, I think that's how you keep the vocal forward, not with compression and, you know, dynamic EQ and stuff like that, you know?
Well, it reminds me of a musical theater approach where they're, you know, literally pushing a fader for every line in the show. And there's less reliance on, like you said, you know, dynamic processes.
Exactly.
And you recently switched to the Waves. You're on the LV1 console now. Is that right?
I did. And, you know, I just wanted to touch on the theater thing for a second. I was lucky enough to see a Motown Broadway type show at a theater in Chicago, and I sat in the balcony right above the sound mixer and watched the way his fingers moved on the desk and how far he moved the vocal faders, and that he brought them below the noise floor when there was no one singing into them. And, you know, I noticed other engineers like Pooch is not afraid to move the fader up and down a lot, you know, on his vocals and any instrument, really, you know. And just watching engineers like that and hearing their result, you know, that sort of gave me the clue to try that, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely a different, you know, I like to say that, you know, a lot of pop and rock mixing, it can be sort of like general rudder changes, very gentle adjustments. And then when you get into, you know, like the musical theater, that's a whole different ballgame for me. And I recently finished a production of West Side Story, and it is, you can't lose your focus for a second. You know, it's full on, you're throwing the faders around old school.
your resume of metal is pretty intensive. So you've been dealing with the scream to a whisper vocal for a long time in your career. What was, and just looking it over, man, like some of my favorite bands of all time, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners too, Slayer, Hatebreed, Deftones, even Social Distortion, which one was the easiest to chase for you, and which one do you think was the hardest out of your career?
One of the most challenging vocalists to mix was probably for Megadeth with Dave Mustaine. He sings very softly.
And I've heard that before.
And he
sure
has an incredibly loud, at the time anyways, had an incredibly loud amp line. And so it was quite a challenge. Yeah. And, but it's, you find ways to overcome it, you know, and, you know, you find ways to get a little bit extra gain, or, you know, that's what the job is. You know, overcome the challenge.
Who was the easiest to chase? Like, who did you not have to worry about as much? That would almost be like when I look through your resume, I'm like, oh, Mike Ness. Like, he probably just gave you a real solid vocal. But there's probably a different one that you're going to pick.
I mean, Ness was fantastic. One thing with Mike Ness, his guitar was incredibly loud. He had basically two settings for his rig, and it was on and off. You know, he had Fender Bassman amps and Marshall cabinets. You know, and they were set to, I don't know if it was on 10 literally, but they were set quite loud, and you know, it just had natural distortion. It was a Samson wireless, and you know, just those two heads, and it sounded just so wonderful. Yeah, you know? But it was loud. You know, I look at all of the bands as you just try to find out what's special about what they're doing right there at the show or at the sound check or wherever your first meeting is, you know, and go from there. Like Limp Bizkit was an interesting one because I was mixing Social Distortion on the Warped Tour, and a friend of mine was working with Limp Bizkit, and he invited me to come over and listen to them. And I'd heard them in the background, you know, just the vocal blaring through the PA basically. And, you know, it was annoying sounding. I had no interest in listening to them. And finally, you know, Glenn, my buddy, coaxed me over there, and I sat on the stage sort of behind the amp line next to the drums and could really hear what the guitar player and the bass player and the drummer and the DJ were doing. And, you know, they were all doing really interesting things musically. You know, like I'd never heard a DJ playing his turntables through a Marshall amp with pedals and, you know, fuzz boxes and, you know, echoes and stuff, you know, like, so I was like, wow, this will be amazing to mix now that I, you know, look at it more objectively, you know. So I guess just looking at what the individual musicians are doing is important to me. Yeah.
I like that you
had a little bit
of
rambling.
No worries. I mean, that's what we need to hear is the ramblings, because you've mixed for so many different bands. Like, that was Limp Bizkit in the heyday. That was $3 Bill. That was like
Lady they were Sight doing Cambodia tour, and $3
yeah,
Bill.
Man, so
that was the actual heyday of nu metal. Like, it was actually a thing then, and that's a challenge, especially, I know you're a musician yourself. I always follow you on Facebook. I see you checking out guitars. It seems like when Bruce isn't mixing metal, he likes to listen to chill blues and chill music.
I do. Yeah, my wife and I, we go to Chicago and go to blues bars a lot. Like, one of our recent vacations was to Blues Fest, and we'll go, you know, to all the little blues clubs like Roses and Kingston Mines, and, you know, even House of Blues in the cafe. They have, like, you know, local blues bands that play original music, which is, I think it's pretty amazing, you know, because there's all the bands that'll play Sweet Home Chicago and, you know, all the standard, you know, Sweet Home Chicago and whatever, you know, but the bands that play original songs are the ones that I'm more attracted to. You know, I want to hear somebody's story or whatever. You know, I want to hear them play. I don't want to hear them do covers so much, you know.
For sure. I live in this place that's called St. Louis, and we actually have the Stanley Cup Champion Blues. Maybe you've heard of them.
Yeah.
Just kidding. I always try to throw that
Chuck
somewhere
Berry.
In the podcast.
Chuck Berry.
Yeah, Chuck Berry for sure.
So, Bruce, let me ask you a more technical question. As a mixer, what's your relationship with your system tech? What are you looking for from the system tech? What kind of communication do you have? Is it sort of, you know, some artists that I work with, some mixers that I work with, they want me to tune the system, and then they'll go, yep, sounds good. And then I hand them the keys and they're off. And some have some want to be a lot more involved, and they have an idea of the target curve they want, and they want to come around and look at the analyzer, and it's a very collaborative process. And where are you on that spectrum?
If we're on tour versus, say, doing a festival, right? I think those are two different things. Sure. If we're doing a festival, I want to come in and I want the systems engineer to hand me a PA that is sort of set to nominal gain, where if I'm sending my console at 0 dB, I'm going to hit somewhere around 100 decibels out in the main part of the crowd, you know? Mm-hmm. And I want it to be a linear response. You know, I don't want there to be peaks and valleys in the frequency response or tonality of the PA. And obviously, you know, it needs to be in time and phase and all that stuff. But, you know, but I would like the systems engineer to give me a PA that you know, I would call flat, you know, which a lot of engineers are going to have problem, you know, with that language or whatever, you know, because, you know, you move 2 feet away and it's not flat anymore or whatever. So you have to make an educated guess on where you're going to settle on what flat is, you know. But I want it to be as neutral as possible, you know. And if I'm on tour with the same system and systems tech, you know, I obviously want the same things. And, you know, I would have them tune the PA and make it as, you know, as close as they think they can get it. And then, you know, on my console, I will make a couple of little adjustments, you know, or maybe I'll ask them to, you know, adjust something in the system, you know, to flatten off or fill in some hole or peak that I find, you know. But generally, as long as they've, you know, gotten it as close to a linear response, I'm happy. And during the show, you know, I would expect that they, you know, give a actual listen to the front fills. Are they actually comfortable? Or are they killing the people up there? You know, I would expect that they go up in the stands and give a listen and make sure that, you know, we made the right choices in the afternoon, you know. But, you know, and with that, I want them to be able to make their own decisions, and they don't have to ask me during the show if they're going to make an adjustment. You know, I trust that they're going to, whatever adjustment they're going to make to the PA is going to make my mix better. You know what I mean? Like that's why they're there, to help make the mix better and to help sort of quality control in a way. And, you know, second set of ears too, you know, like, you know, if it's a little bit harsh one evening, you know, maybe the systems engineer might go, you know, hey, it's a little bit harsh tonight, you know, let's, you know, and so it's, I don't know, it's systems engineer is essential to have a good relationship with and to respect what they do and what they can offer you, you know?
Right. Yeah. That's an important, you know, some mix engineers, they don't want any feedback at all, which is fine. You know, I would never tell a mix engineer how to mix, but, you know, it's nice when they're, you know, open to me saying, you know, just so you know, the subs aren't really carrying as far up into the back as we wanted. So just, you know, be aware of that, and to have that dialogue, which really helps, you know, us, your job and my job, which is to make sure that everyone hears the best show they can hear, you know, that communication is really valuable.
Yeah, and I'm not going to micromanage the way, you know, they deploy the PA from day to day. They, you know, the system check is going to know that I want the PA to cover to the barricade. So they're going to make sure that it covers, you know, spills onto the stage a little bit more than some engineers might like, you know. And they're going to know that I definitely want it to go to the back of the room too, you know. So they're, so, you know, I lay out expectations, you know, beforehand, so nothing's a surprise too, you know. And that, I think that helps, you know, just communicating, you know, like what you actually want of the systems tech, you know.
Right.
So back in the day of your club tours, I saw you do one of the coolest things, and I think this is what I remember you from. Not only were you one of the cooler engineers that came through the venue, is you took the house EQ that was already set and you just took it out of your mix. And you told me a story when I was a younger gentleman about how you were just giving energy back to the desk so you could push the desk. And I thought it was one of the coolest things. And I was still trying to remember what band it was. It might have been Static X. I'm not even sure.
If it was between 99 and 2009, good chances are it was Static X. I was with them for a long time. But, yeah, a lot of times you suck up all the gain of the PA by over EQing. You know, and I'm guilty of that to this day sometimes. You know, on this very last tour, as I was getting used to my new console, I was trying to find just the overall gain structure and where everything should sit. And, you know, a couple times, because my overall gain structure was off, you know, meaning I'm sending too much signal to the PA, I over EQ'd to compensate and just dug myself into a hole, you know, where I, you know, by the end of the tour, you know, that'll never happen again or whatever, you know, because, you know, you make a mistake, you know, a couple of times and you learn, you know, but, you know, that's over EQing is dangerous, you know, and I'm, like I said, I'm still guilty of it sometimes. And I find some of the most successful mixes I have, I've not, you know, I've not made any drastic EQ moves, you know. I want to make sure that everything is smooth, you know, like the, and comfortable, not, you know.
I know you're not much of a plug-in guy. So with the new Waves stuff, did you kind of sway away from that?
Well, I'm completely a plug-in mixer now. I guess in the studio, they would call that mixing in the box or something. So I guess that's what I do now. And yeah, I as you asked a little while ago, and I totally interrupted and changed the subject. I did switch to a Waves LV1 mixing console, and I love it. I can't say enough good things about my experience mixing on it. You know, it sounds fantastic, and you know, the plugins I've chosen to use work perfect for this band. You know, like the Shep's Omni channel is the basically the channel strip that I'm using for the console, you know, and it sounds just amazing, you know, and just the EQ on it is really versatile. The compressor on it sounds good, and the gate is, you know, fantastic. We have so many toms and stuff on the drum kit. You know, the gates are really important, you know, and that was one of the things I was worried about, is making sure that I could, you know, have a good noise gate. And because on the Midas console that I've been using for a few years, that has one of the best noise gates I've ever used. And, you know, it never false triggered, and I didn't have to do anything weird. Just use the key filter and, you know, just find the frequency, and, you know, that the cymbals or whatever, the snare drum doesn't open the gate, and it's perfect, you know. And so I needed to make sure I could do that, you know, within the plug-in land or whatever, and the Shep's, you know, omni-channel gate seemed to be the best one that I tried in the Waves world, you know, and all of the effects sound really good. You know, I've got I keep it really simple. It's basically been the same effects setup since the mid 90s when I've, you know, started having a choice in what I could have, you know, and, you know, that's two delays, some kind of pitch change, you know, for the and a reverb for the vocal, and two reverbs for the drums, and some kind of subharmonic synth type of thing for the drums, and you know, that's all I use and need as far as effects, you know. And I sort of keep that set up the same way from project to project too, so it's, you know, just always, you know, I just always know where certain things are, you know. And yeah,
and the LV system you can fly with too.
You know, I didn't build mine as you can. Yes, I didn't build mine as a fly rig necessarily. I sort of thought to myself, with, you know, I'm in a fortunate position to be mixing a very popular band, and I can have any console I want. So I'm sure that we have space for me to take a Digico or a Pro X or a Avid or, you know, whatever, you know, any of the great consoles. And you know, so it's like, if I just have it built efficiently and in a small package that I can manage, that's comfortable to mix on, you know, it's like the comfort of mixing on it and the ease of putting it together and making sure that there's the minimum amount of wear and tear from day to day was what I was, you know, what was important to me with this system. Because, you know, I think some of the fly rigs might be a little bit too fragile. Like, you know, I would be scared having it thrown around in a small case. You know, it's in a nice big 16 space shock mounted thing, you know, like it's well protected, you know. So, yeah. So it's like when we're planning a few shows next year that would involve flying. Well, I think there are three shows outside of a normal tour that would involve flying. And for that, I'll just use, you know, locally provided consoles. You know, I'll spec an Avid or a Midas and, you know, I'll build a little show file and have fun making a mix. You know, I don't use scenes anyways, you know, so it's easy to use whichever console, you know.
What was your speaker box of choice on this last tour?
This last tour, my speaker box of choice was the one that they gave me each day because we were doing festivals and local shows. And like we did basically, I think it was 11 shows in about 3 weeks. And it was half festivals and half headline shows and arenas and the Armory, you know, was the only non-arena show. And well, I guess there were a couple amphitheaters too. But anyways, it was a rig du jour. I think the best rigs we had were L-Acoustics K2 systems, and we had a really nice DMB J8 system. And the rig that that we had at the Armory from the name of the company escapes me at the moment, but we had them for 2 days in a row. They gave us a Vertec rig that was badass, you know, and I, several of the festivals we had on this run had Vertec rigs of some sort. Yeah. But my preference in PA these past couple of years has been somewhere in between DMB stuff and the L-Acoustic stuff and Claire stuff. Like I think those are the best three PAs, and Adamson too, obviously. Like the E15s are amazing sounding, you know. So as long as I have one of those like four or five PAs and enough of it and a good systems tech, I'm happy, you know.
So Bruce, how you mentioned a pretty, you know, arenas and sheds and amps and that type of thing. How much do you change in your mix based on the room that you're in? What are you
zero?
Zero, nothing at all?
Nothing at all. I start off from, I have some HS5 monitors and some Sennheiser headphones. I build the mix at, you know, at home based on the last tour's multi-tracks. And even since I've been able to, you know, use virtual sound check, I've been doing this. I'll just delete the entire show file and start from scratch every few tours just to keep it fresh. You know, there's certain things that stay the same, you know, like I use, you know, groups for, you know, the different like kick and snare and toms and cymbals, and each guitar and bass has its own group, background vocals and the, you know, lead vocal have their own groups, you know. But I don't know. Does that address your question, or what was?
Yeah, what, I just what, you know, I found if I'm outside, I'll tend to use a little more reverb or a slightly longer reverb. You know, if I'm in a reverberant room, I'll pull it back, that type of thing.
Think of this. What's a favorite record of yours where there's a snare drum reverb that's accented somehow?
Oh, I'd say like Phil Collins, maybe.
Phil Collins, great example. So play that Phil Collins record in a dry ass studio and it sounds wonderful. Play that Phil Collins record in the Georgia Dome in an echoey stadium. It still has that reverb on it. Right. The artist, in my opinion, the artist still wants that reverb. Now you have to really control your dynamics and frequency response to get a reverb to, you know, to play right, I suppose. And it has to be part of the song. It can't just be because I have this cool reverb and I want the audience to hear my engineering skills, you know, right. Like, you know, if it's not part of the song or making the song better, you shouldn't be doing it, you know?
Right.
And, you know, if you're, as the engineer, if you're contributing something to the song that the band did not ask for, it better be cool, you know?
I think that's one of the pitfalls that I see, particularly some younger engineers falling into. Because now that we have, you know, the ability to run pretty much unlimited DSP, unlimited plugins on our systems these days, it's very easy to get into, oh, which vintage reverb emulation do I want to use on this song? When in fact we should be focusing on, you know, the music and the message and what the artist is doing, and it can be a little too easy to get your head kind of down in your effects rack instead of looking at the stage.
Yeah, that, I mean, I think that was a problem in the analog days too. You know, people would get the latest whatever and think that's the answer to having a good mix. You know, but no, just gear is not the answer to a good mix.
Right.
Yeah.
Gear dropped the G, your ear.
yeah, and like until you know why you want to use something, like, you know, different effects or whatever, like compression is a pretty good one, you know, like, does anyone even know what it does, you know? So why are you using compression? What are you using it for? What's, you know, like, are you using it because you saw this other engineer using it, or are you using it because it enhances your mix in some positive way, you know?
Right.
And why did you choose whichever attack time or release time or whatever it is that you're doing, you know? And, you know, it's, I think that people should really be cautious about using, like, they should think of all of these things as tools, you know, and you know, you don't just pile on every tool you have, you know, like you find the right tool and you use it sparingly, and, you know.
Well, you're appealing to my system tech mentality, you know, because I'm always going after a problem. There's a goal I want to get to, and based on that, I'll choose an approach or a tool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I'm mixing, I try to take the same approach, which is, yeah, okay, I have a compressor on every channel of my desk, but I'm not just going to go through and slap them all in because they're there. I'm not going to do it until I go, oh yeah, I think compression might help me do what I'm trying to do here. And then, you know, like you said, I've got a problem I'm trying to solve or a goal I'm trying to reach. And if I mm-hmm. think a piece of gear or a process will get me there, then I'll try that.
C6 is probably what drove me away from using plugins for years before I started using multi-rack with my Midas console. And seeing that pink line move so much and just hearing these mixes that were just so compressed and the dynamics were just off because it's a dynamic EQ and it's changing the response of things in an unnatural way to my ear, you know?
Right.
Like I just, you know, I don't like dynamic EQ, but as I say that, you know, there's engineers like Mads Mikkelsen, you know, mixes Volbeat, who uses dynamic EQ a lot, as far as I can tell. And God, his mix sounds perfect, you know?
Right.
So, you know, it's, so there's no right way or whatever, you know, it's just,
I think that Volbeat is just preference. Loud.
Volbeat really,
is,
yeah, like their stage volume is incredible, dude. We did them at the Marquee Theater in Phoenix one time and they were trying out those new, holy cow, like their stage volume was louder than Motorhead when I was hanging out on stage one time. I was like, how do they even do this? But you go out front and, like you said, it was just like all put together correct. And that's a talent in itself, man. Like, I think a monitor engineer working with a front of house guy can, you know, that could destroy your mix or make your mix. But holy cow, like, it's two different worlds. Listening on the stage to Volbeat and front of house, it's like, how did he do that? Like,
yeah, the monitor guy has to make sure that the frequency response sort of his of any side fills and, you know, wedges that gels with the room. It doesn't resonate in a undesirable way, you know. And you know, if as long as they do that, they can make it really loud and punchy on stage without affecting front of house. For me, stage volume doesn't matter as long as it's even. I'm not going to tell a band to turn. I'm more likely to tell one of the guitar players to turn up than to tell the other one to turn down, you know. And by tell, I mean request politely, you know. They set their instruments where they set them, you know, and sometimes, you know, one of them can be a little bit carried away, you know, just because they have in-ears in and they're not aware that just that one little nudge on the amp, you know, is a huge difference in volume, you know. And one of the solutions that I've found for that is once the band are comfortable with where their levels are after a few shows, we'll take measurements. Even though I don't use mics, I use Palmer PDI-09s to capture the guitars. I'll take a decibel measurement where where a mic would be on the speaker cone, you know, and I'll make sure I'll find what level each guy is at where they're comfortable, and that will be the level for the tour. So their cabinets will always be like Jason's is always on his main sound. It's 113. At the mic position, and on his solo sound, it's 116 at his mic position. And Zoltan is 110 at his mic position. And the bass guitar is 103 at the bass cabinet's mic position. And if we have those things set evenly, everything works. Everything sort of builds from there. You know, it starts off with the band being naturally sounding balanced.
Are they all on ears?
Except for the singer, yes. And the drummer uses only ears, no wedges or thumper or subwoofer or anything. And, you know, the stage left guitar player Zoltan uses a combination of wedges and ears. And he has sort of a sweet spot where the wedges are 18 feet from his cabinets. And he stands, you know, somewhere right in the middle. And basically the wedges should be about the same volume, you know, about 103 dB, you know, or 105. Or I'm sorry, well, 110 is where the guitar is, but whatever. Details. They should be the same volume. And he finds that zone where he can step in or out and you know, has his sweet spot, you know, and the other guitar player, Jason, he uses his wedge for a footrest. You know, there's really nothing in it other than a little bit of vocal and some kick and snare, you know. And the singer, he has no in-ears, that is. So he has a traditional mix, you know, just of everything. You know, it sounds like a rock band. You know, there's everything in the side fills and, you know, a basic mix of everything in his wedges, and you know, it's just natural, straightforward rock and roll.
You've been touring for quite some time. Obviously, like, one of the questions that comes up with touring individuals and I like to talk about is like, how do you keep yourself sane? Like, you're in and out of home a lot. Right now you're home for a few weeks. You just got home from tour and then vacation. Do you go through bouts of like anxiety that you're not on the road or that you are, or talk about that a little bit?
Well, one thing that's always been important to me is not jumping from tour to tour or gig to gig, you know, having time off at home to just enjoy living is one of the most awesome parts of this type of career for me personally, you know, because like I try to put myself in a position where I'm working directly with an artist and, you know, I'm their guy, you know, so I'm going to be there as long as they're touring is the plan, you know, for me, you know, and that gives me freedom of not having to constantly search for work. And there's also the fear of, hey, they might get tired of me and, you know, replace me for whatever any reason, you know, that can happen at any time, you know. But the you know, it's, I don't know, does that explain it at all?
Definitely. I mean, I always found myself in a place of anxiety too, where like I wanted to be home sometimes, but then when I got home for too long, I was like, man, I gotta go. And it became a process for me where I was with the band for a long time too. And when I'd go on break while they were recording an album, I kind of didn't know what to do with myself. And my lady would point it out to me, man, I need to put a generator underneath the bed and you need to sleep underneath there, 'cause you're not sleeping right. You're not eating right. And then I'd go back on the road and then I'd have anxiety that I wasn't home. So
yeah. You've been touring for some time. I practice martial arts,
and that's one of the things that is just a fun activity that occupies my time, if anything else, you know. So when I'm on the road, you know, it kills a lot of the free time that would be monotonous, you know. And when I'm at home, you know, it's one of the things I look forward to doing, you know. And I, you know, like I play guitar, you know, I love going to shows. Our next show my wife and I are going to is a blues guy called Selwyn Birchwood. you know. So I,
well, you still have passion for it, so that's good. Like when I get home, yeah. I don't want to go to a show.
See, I swear I'm one of the few people in this business that loves music. You know, like I think it's awesome. I'm fascinated that I've been able to make a living by getting to choose. I get to stand in the middle of a room and choose how it sounds, and they pay me a bunch of money for that. Like that's awesome. yeah.
Well,
I like
that
part about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's, I've said to Kyle before, you know, if I ever get to the point where I wake up and I realize I'm not excited about this, time for me to do something else, you know?
It is. And there's plenty of people that are excited that would love to have your job. Like, yeah, you know, there's people lined up for all of our jobs in this industry, you know? So,
and they'll take hundreds of dollars less.
Yeah, you know, your deal is what you make. You know, people. I hear people complain about wages a lot on various online forums, and it fascinates me. You know, so I've put a few ads out. You know, I'm a production manager as well, so I hire people for various jobs, and you know, I'll put ads out, and some people that I see publicly talking about how much they will or won't work for will privately be begging me for a job for half of the price that they scoffed at somebody else offering. Yeah. And it's just, it's funny because every gig sort of pays different. There is no standard of what somebody makes in this industry. You make your own deal, and you know, if so, I don't know.
Well, let's dovetail that with a question that I always like to ask people. If you could give one piece of advice to someone who's interested in getting into the business or wants to do what you do for a living, what would that be?
Ask questions. And that's one, but I'm going to give a couple of pieces of advice.
Please, absolutely.
Ask questions and listen to what other people are doing with their mixes, and look at how they're doing it and try to understand their methods, good or bad. You know, some of the best young engineers that I have, you know, seen lately happen to have the name Brian. There's a couple of young engineers named Brian out there that are just awesome, you know. And, you know, I see them looking at what other people are doing and taking it and studying it and seeing how they can integrate this little piece of it into their mix, you know. They're not copying anybody. They're taking little pieces of, oh, check this technique out. I can get my vocal louder here, or I can get my guitars to sound better here, you know. And they just watch and listen to everybody, whether they're like a, you know, at the top of the bill or the headliner, you know. Like even when we do these festivals, I go out and listen to everyone's mix. You know, I might not stay out there for the entire show for everyone, but, you know, I want to hear what they're doing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I listen to other people's mixes, ask questions, and try to develop relationships with engineers that you respect, you know, and that gives, you know, the more comfortable they feel with you, the more information they'll freely share with you, you know, and that sort of mentorship is important, I think, in this type of business, you know, like, because anybody can learn the technical part of how a mixing console works and how to make sound come through it, you know, but the artistic side of mixing and communicating with artists, that's like really important, you know, like, and you learn that by being thrown into challenging situations, you know. If the artist has a misunderstanding about something, they might not know how to articulate something that's very simple. And if you do not approach it in a calm, cool, understanding way, or if you make them feel stupid for not knowing how to articulate their problem, you're not going to last. You know, you have to, you know, really understand how to communicate with the artist and everyone you encounter, you know, like the staff, you know, people that are working with me. If I talk down to people on my crew, you know, they're going to revolt. They're not going to respect what I ask, you know. But if I speak to them all with complete respect all the time, you know, even if I'm bitching at them about something, you know, I'm going to do it respectfully and most of the time in private, you know. And so it's just don't complain, I think, would be the other advice. Complaining is poison on tour, and that shows, you know, if you're working for a local sound company and there's, you know, like four of you guys on the crew and you're going to be there for like 18 hours that day and then you have to drive the gear back to some shop or some shit, you know, like all of you guys are tired, all of you worked hard, don't be the guy that bitches about it.
I would never want to see you mad, Bruce, but you're one of the coolest, calmest dudes out there, and that's one of the highly respected, like, we've had podcasts before where that's basically the topic of conversation is how do you get along with people that you run into every day, and you are an icon for that, my man. I follow you on everything, and one, glad to have you here. Two, you have a Facebook page for your mix engineer stuff. Do you want to give that out to the people, or?
I do, but I'm old and I don't know exactly how to do that. It's, well, Bruce Ryder Mix something, I guess, right? I don't know what it is.
It's Bruce Ryder FOH Mixing, mixing engineer, and it's basically just your travels and some video and some photos of your shows, your setup. I think it'd be super helpful for the younger listeners out there.
Well, we'll put that in the description of this podcast, yeah, on the website.
Put a link in it, please. And I post nerdy pictures that I would want to see if I was, you know, a young engineer or something, or even an engineer, like, oh wow, that's cool how you guys did that, or oh, that's ridiculous, or whatever. Yeah.
You take great photos too.
It's fun. They got these iPhone things now, man. It's the camera is amazing. You know, it's so much easier than it used to be. You know, I have film that I haven't developed from the, I think, mid-80s, you know, but with the modern technology, just put it right in the internet.
So we will put Bruce's Facebook page link in the description of this podcast.
Please do.
And also, for anyone listening, if you have questions, comments, feedback, you can email us, signal2noisepodcast@gmail.com. Also, any insults you have for Kyle can be sent right to that email address, and it'll go straight to his
directly to me.
Nice mustache.
Thank you.
Bruce, thank you so much for being here with us today, man. It was a real pleasure speaking with you, and thank you for sharing your knowledge with us.
My pleasure, and thanks for letting me ramble on and babble, and yeah, take care of y'all.
You rule, Bruce. We'll come see you, man.
All right. Looking forward to it. Be well, y'all.
See ya.
Cheers.